Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Genesis chapter 9, verses 1 through 17. I'm going to call this section of Scripture God's Covenant with Noah, Part B. We took up Part A in the previous audio in Genesis 8, 15 through 22, and we'll finish the discussion of Noah's covenant here. After the flood was over, we start with verse 1. God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth." The creation is beginning anew here. It's been wiped out by the flood, and God is starting over. Now, notice the parallels with the original creation, as the NIV Study Bible points out, and a lot of people point this out. There's lots of parallels between the creation account and the flood account. I'm just going to give you three here. I've given more in previous audios. The benediction, God blessed Noah. Well, God blessed Adam and Eve too, Genesis 1:28. God blessed them, Adam and Eve, and said to them. So there's a benediction upon the people who are going to populate the earth. There's a provision of food in the Genesis account, and there's a provision for food in the account here of Noah's covenant. The provision for food in the creation account can be seen in Genesis 1:29-30. God also said, "Look, I've given you every seed-bearing plant on the surface of the entire earth, and every tree whose fruit contains seed. This food will be for you. For all the wildlife of the earth, for every bird of the sky, for every creature that crawls on the earth, everything having the breath of life in it, I have given every green plant for food." In other words, for all the animals and Adam and Eve, there was plants for them to eat. We see here in Genesis 9:3, God says to Noah, "Every creature that lives and moves will be food for you. As I gave the green plants, I've given you everything." He gave the green plants in Genesis 1:29-30, and he gives everything now, animals included, Genesis 9:3. So that's the second parallel, provision for food. The third parallel is dominion over the earth. Adam had dominion over the earth, and Noah had dominion over the earth. Let's look at the case of Adam, Genesis 1:28. God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, and subdue it." That means take dominion over it. "Rule the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, and every creature that crawls on the earth." Take dominion over the animals. Genesis 9:2, Genesis 1:28, that was God talking to Adam and Eve. And now we look in Genesis 9:2, God is talking to Noah. "The fear and terror of you will be in every living creature on the earth, every bird of the sky, every creature that crawls on the ground, and all the fish of the sea. They are placed under your authority." So the provisions are obvious. You don't have to strain to see them. We are now looking at a new creation. Genesis 9:2, "The fear and terror of you will be in every living creature on the earth." I just read that verse, actually. "Every bird of the sky, every creature that crawls on the ground, and all the fish of the sea, they are placed under your authority." John Gill says, as I just said, that this is a renewal, at least in part, of the grant of dominion to Adam over all the creatures. I don't know why it's in part. It seems to me it's the same thing. Psalms 8:6 reflects this. "You made him Lord over the works of your hands. You, God, made him man Lord over the works of your hands, over God's hands, the works of God's hands. You put everything under his feet." You, God, put everything under Adam's feet. Authority. We have authority over this world. That does not mean that we exploit it and hurt the environment, so because that hurts other people. There are certain skeptical anti-Christians who say, "See there, the church is against the environment because this verse says that we're supposed to have a dominion over the animals." The reason you have dominion over the animals is so you can take care of them, so that you can have game laws so they will propagate properly and not get hunted out, so that forest will be preserved. It's not mean that you exploit it like some kind of a strip miner who doesn't cover up the mining after he's finished. We go now to Genesis. Oh, first of all, let's look at this. "The fear and terror of you will be in every living creature." Terror. Gill, Clark, and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, all three say, "Before the fall, the animals obeyed man out of love. And after the fall, they obey out of terror." That's kind of interesting. That's a speculation, I think. I mean, I know animals today that obey their masters out of total love, especially dogs. Maybe not cats, but dogs certainly do. So that's an interesting speculation. I'm not sure it's true. Genesis 9:3. "Every living creature will be food for you. As I gave the green plants, I have given you everything." Now, when God tells Noah every living creature will be food, that means that includes meat. Before the flood, it can be presumed that men were vegetarians by looking at Genesis chapter 1, verse 29. God also said, "Look, I've given you every seed-bearing plant on the surface of the entire earth and every tree whose fruit contains seed. This food will be for you." No mention there of animals. And you could say, well, that's just an argument from silence. Yes, but why would God not mention the animals if when he's given everybody else vegetables? Now, that's controverted, actually. I mentioned it in, I think, the Old Earth, New Earth controversy in the introductory audios to Genesis. I'm not going to go over all that again. I'm just going to assume that mankind was vegetarian before the fall and after the, or before the flood, I should say. And then after the flood, our human ancestors started eating steak and hamburgers. Well, why the difference? Why is it okay to eat meat now, but not before the fall? Well, here's some options to answer that. Number one, plants were not able to sustain life after the flood as plants were able to do before the flood. Adam Clark says that the flood made plants not as nutritive as before. Soaking in all that water in the bottom of the sea, maybe. Interesting speculation. Here's another option as to why God says time to eat animals. This is from the idea of Adam Clark that man was physically degenerated since the fall. So he needs to eat meat because things are rougher on him. The environment's worse. He needs to eat meat to give him more strength. Here's the quote from Adam Clark, quote, "Morbid debility induced by an often unfriendly state of the atmosphere with sore and long continued labor would necessarily require a higher nutriment than vegetables could supply. That the constitution of man was then much altered appears in the greatly contracted lives of the post-diluvians." In other words, life has gotten so bad on the planet you can't go through your workday without having meat to give you protein and energy. Now, before I go any further over this vegetarian meat-eating distinction, we need to note that you cannot connect sin with eating meat. Now, there's a lot of religions that do that. I know most vegetarians here in America, they don't do it for religious reasons. They do it because it's better for the health, and I'm sure it is, perhaps. But there are many Eastern religions, for example, Hinduism and Buddhism, that connect sin with eating meat. Well, that can't be, because here, after the fall, no one ate meat. It was only after the flood that they ate meat. But before the flood and after the fall, mankind was sinful. There was sin everywhere, but they were not eating meat. So eating meat has absolutely nothing to do with sinning. Sinners were vegetarian before the fall, and sinners were meat eaters after the fall. We go to Genesis 9:4. "However, you must not eat meat with its lifeblood in it." So there was a restriction on the ability to eat meat, no meat with its lifeblood in it. That would mean if you tried to eat a live animal, ugh, which is disgusting, or an animal which is freshly slaughtered but has not had the blood drained out of it, you're not supposed to eat it. Now, we're very familiar with this restriction because it was codified in the Mosaic Law, and this is long before the Mosaic Law. Leviticus 17:11 says, for the life of a creature is in the blood, and I have appointed it to you to make atonement on the altar for your lives, since it is the lifeblood that makes atonement. So blood is associated with life, and that's reasonable, because if you see blood running out of an animal, you notice the animal dies. And I'm sure the ancients, the antediluvians, saw that and understood that life is with the blood. Now, the next question is why would God forbid this? Well, before we answer that question, why would anyone purposely eat the blood that God would have to forbid it? Well, people would eat blood back then to try to preserve or increase his life. They noticed that blood gave life, and they said, well, if that blood from that animal gave the animal life, and now the blood is drained out of that animal, it's still got life in it, so I'm going to eat it so I can get more life, more strength. Kind of like taking testosterone supplements or something. Now, as a matter of fact, as the NIV Study Bible points out, many pagan peoples throughout history have tried to do this by eating blood. And God says, nope, don't want you to do that. Now, I think the reason that God said that is because he's going to use blood for sacrifice to show that blood stands for life. Life has to be taken in order to atone for sin, because capital punishment for our sin is the only thing that satisfies divine justice. And so he wants to segregate the uses of blood out for that sacred and holy purpose of sacrifice. So he doesn't want the blood to be profaned by sinners eating the blood. Now, this prohibition on eating blood was before the fall, right here in Genesis 9:4, at the time of Noah's covenant. It was repeated in the time of Moses in the Mosaic Law, Leviticus 17:11, which I've already read. And also this idea of not eating blood was repeated after the Mosaic Law in the New Covenant at the Jerusalem Council. Let me read the associated scriptures dealing with the Jerusalem Council, Acts 15:20. But instead, we should write to them, to the Gentiles, to abstain from things polluted by idols, from sexual immorality, from eating anything that has been strangled, and from blood. In other words, don't eat blood, Gentiles. You're going to offend the Jews, Acts 15:29. This is a report. I think this is the letter itself, that you should abstain from food offered to idols, from blood. Acts 21:25. Looking back to the Jerusalem Council, with regard to the Gentiles who have believed, we have written a letter containing our decision that they should keep themselves from food sacrificed to idols, from blood. So there was three references there to the Jerusalem Council. New Testament Christians were not supposed to eat blood. Now, the question that raises in my mind is this prohibition on eating blood, is that binding on New Testament Christians? Well, here's some arguments to say that there's no prohibition in eating blood of animals. For example, when you eat steak, it's got gravy in it. I love steak. And I remember one time I was looking at the gravy and I said, you know, that looks like there's blood in that gravy. And it turns out there is. A little bit, not a lot, but there's blood in the gravy. It's not just fat grease, it's blood. Well, okay, let's say I eat that, but I'm not eating that steak to gain extra years. I'm not doing that for any religious purpose. I'm just eating it because the steak tastes good. So I would say that means that the prohibition on eating blood would not apply to eating steak with gravy. Second argument that the prohibition on eating blood does not apply to New Testament Christians is easy. We're not under the law of Moses. That Leviticus was for Jews, not me. The third argument that there's no prohibition, the Jerusalem Council prohibitions, which were given in the New Covenant, but they were to protect against Jews stumbling because of their law. Now, today, of course, if I ate blood and caused a Jew to stumble, I would be sinning. I shouldn't do that. But assuming that there's no Jewish person who's upset about eating blood, it's perfectly okay to eat it. Now, that's not to say that it's aesthetically pleasing to eat it. In fact, if somebody just drank blood, I think that's disgusting. I know people have done that before, and it's just disgusting to me. And it's probably unhealthy. It's probably full of every kind of disease known to man. But not in steak. All right, so now we see that the prohibition has been around for a long time, before, during, and after the Mosaic Law. Here's some options as to why God made the prohibition. Option number one, to preserve the wonder around the mysterious and precious gift of life from God. In other words, to kind of make it holy. That's reasonable. Option number two as to why the prohibition. To prevent excesses of cannibal ferocity in eating flesh of living animals. That's Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Not only is that a stretch to me, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown also says this is the sole intention of the prohibition of eating blood, to keep humans from acting like cannibals while they're chomping on live animals. I have a hard time believing that one. The third reason why God might have made the prohibition is to protect from disease, practical reason. We go now to Genesis chapter 9, verses 5 and 6. I will require the life of every animal and every man for your life and your blood. I will require the life of each man's brother for a man's life. Whoever sheds man's blood, his blood will be shed by man, for God made man in his image. This is the famous capital punishment verse. It's before the law. I'm going to read you verses that show that it's in the law in just a minute. It's before the law, it's during the law, and it's after the law too, because Paul in Romans 13, after the Mosaic law was abrogated, Paul said that the government had the power of the sword, and swords, what do swords do? They kill people, they capitally execute people. So capital punishment is everywhere in the scriptures. I'm sorry for all you anti-capital punishment people. I've got a lot of scriptures here to try to suggest to you that it's quite foolish to try to say that the Bible is against capital punishment. So let's look at these scriptures. Now, as I go through these scriptures, they are in the Old Testament, some of them, and some of them are before the Mosaic Law in the Old Testament in Genesis. And one of them is going to be in the New Testament. So, and some of the scriptures will refer to premeditated murder, and some will refer to manslaughter. Manslaughter is not what's anticipated here or referred to here in Genesis 9:6, where man's blood has to be shed by man if he kills somebody, because that's talking about premeditated murder. All right, so let's start going through some scriptures here. Genesis 4, 9 through 12. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where's your brother Abel?" "I don't know," he replied. "Am I my brother's guardian?" Then he said, "What have you done? Your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. So now you are cursed," God says to Cain. "Alienated from the ground that opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood you have shed." Cain, of course, committed premeditated murder on Abel, his brother Abel. If you work the ground, it will never again give you its yield. You will be a restless wanderer on the earth. Now, this is for premeditated murder. It's not manslaughter. And notice that, well, maybe not in these verses, but if we read the whole story, God put a mark on Cain to keep Cain from being wiped out, which would have been just, but he gave Cain some mercy and said, no, there's a mark on you. You're not going to receive capital punishment. That was for Cain. But in general, in Genesis 9, the rule is you shed man's blood, your blood's going to be shed. Blood for blood, life for life. Now let's go to the law, Exodus 21, 12 through 14. Whoever strikes a person so that he dies must be put to death. But if he didn't intend any harm, and yet God caused it to happen by his hand, I will appoint a place for you where he may flee. Now that's manslaughter, when somebody kills somebody accidentally, like he's chopping wood and the axe flies, the axe head falls off and strikes somebody in the head. But verse 12 says in Exodus 21, whoever strikes a person so that he dies must be put to death. That's referring to intentional murder of someone. But if he did intend any harm, in verse 13, God appoints a place. That's a city of refuge. There were six of them in the Old Testament where you could flee, and the avenger of blood, the kinsman of the dead person, cannot come get the manslaughterer. Can't get him. Verse 14, Exodus 21, if a person schemes and willfully acts against his neighbor to murder him, you must take him from my altar to be put to death. I guess he's at the altar like they always did in the Middle Ages. You know, they grabbed an altar when they were about to get killed, because surely you're not going to kill me in the house of God. But anyway, that's talking about premeditated murder there. Schemes and willfully acts against his neighbor. Schemes is premeditated. Intentional, willfully acts against his neighbor. So there's capital punishment for intentional murder, but not capital punishment for manslaughter in the law. Now let's look in Numbers 35, 16 through 32. If anyone strikes a person with an iron object and death results, he is a murderer. That's intentional. The murderer must be put to death. If a man has in his hand a stone capable of causing death and strikes another person and he dies, the murderer must be put to death. Same thing, intentional, just the object. The murder weapon's different. Instead of iron, it's stone. If a man has in his hand a wooden object capable of causing death and strikes another person and he dies, the murderer must be put to death. All three of those are intentional deaths. The only distinction is the murder weapon. Iron, stone, or wood doesn't make any matter, doesn't make any difference. You kill somebody intentionally, you're going to die. Verse 19, the avenger of blood himself is to kill the murderer. That means the nearest kin of the deceased person comes after the murderer and kills him. They didn't have prison systems back then. They didn't have the electric chair in the prison. They just took care of it on a personal basis. Verse 20, likewise, if anyone in hatred pushes a person or throws an object at him with malicious intent and he dies, or if in hostility he strikes him with his hand and he dies, the one who struck him must be put to death. He is a murderer. And a murderer means intentional killer, not a manslaughterer. That means when you kill somebody, commit a homicide by accident or negligent. But a murderer, no, that's premeditated. The avenger of blood is to kill the murderer when he finds him. But if anyone suddenly pushes a person without hostility or throws any object at him without malicious intent or without looking, drops a stone that could kill a person and he dies, but he was not his enemy and wasn't trying to harm him. In other words, this is an accidental death. Negligent, maybe. Maybe I shouldn't say accidental. It's negligent. It could be an accident. You know, I'm throwing a rock somewhere and somebody comes around the corner and bang, gets hit in the head with the rock. Total accident. I'm not at fault, but by golly, I'm going to have to go flee to the city of refuge because I am a manslaughterer. Usually manslaughter is with negligence. Sometimes it's gross negligence. Sometimes it's just ordinary negligence. The assembly is to judge such a person, to judge between the slayer and the avenger of blood according to these ordinances. In other words, the man's dead, the avenger of blood comes, the relative of the dead man comes to get justice by killing the manslaughterer. And wait a minute, that might not be just. He didn't mean to do it. Verse 25, the assembly is to protect the one who kills someone from the hand of the avenger of blood. Then the assembly will return him to the city of refuge he fled to, and he must live there until the death of the high priest who was anointed with the holy oil. All right, so the person who was a manslaughterer, he doesn't get away scot-free. He doesn't get his freedom. He has to go to a particular city. He has to leave his family and his job and his farm, and he's got to go to the city of refuge and has to stay there until there's a change of regime with the high priest, change of office. He's got to stay there. He can't leave. Verse 26, if the one who kills someone ever goes outside the border of the city of refuge he fled to and the avenger of blood finds him outside the border of his city of refuge and kills him, the avenger will not be guilty of bloodshed. So you can take advantage of the city of refuge, manslaughter, but if you wander outside the environs of that city, the Avenger of Blood can pick you off, and the law's not going to do anything to him. For the one who killed a person was supposed to live in his city of refuge until the death of the high priest. Only after the death of the high priest may the one who has killed a person return to the land he possesses. These instructions will be a statutory ordinance for you throughout your generations wherever you live. If anyone kills a person, and this is intentionally, the murderer is to be put to death based on the word of witnesses. But no one is to be put to death based on the testimony of one witness. You are not to accept a ransom for the life of a murderer who is guilty of killing someone. A lot of times you could get out of punishments in the Old Testament law by paying a ransom either to the temple or to the person that you wronged. Can't do that with a murderer. No ransom. You die. Verse 32, neither should you accept the ransom for the person who flees to the city of refuge. No ransom for the manslaughterer. He's got to stay in that city until the death of the high priest. All right, so it's very clear that there's capital punishment in the law, as I've just given you with extreme detail there. Now let's look in the New Testament, Romans 13, verses 3 through 4. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, Paul writes to the Romans, but to bad, i.e. bad conduct. A terror for bad conduct. Do you want to be unafraid of the authority? Do what is good and you will have its approval. For government is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid because it does not carry the sword for no reason. That's S-W-O-R-D, sword. Now, what does a sword do? A sword kills you. I mean, those government officials didn't turn that sword sideways and pat you on your hiney. No, they ran you through. They chopped your head off. Government is God's servant and avenger that brings wrath on the one who does wrong. So, before, during, and after the law, the scriptures command capital punishment. And when I say command, I mean command. The scriptures don't just permit capital punishment, they command capital punishment. I can't say that strong enough. I remember Chuck Colson, who got a little bit soft, I guess, because he was in prison. So a lot of people got to know, including people that were on death row. He came out against capital punishment. That really ticked me off. But then later in life, he changed his mind and said, nah, the Bible says it. Obviously, the Bible says capital punishment. Now, why? Because when you kill somebody, you've taken the life of someone who is in God's image, as the scripture says here in Genesis 9, verse 6. Whoever sheds man's blood, his blood will be shed by man. For, because God made man in his image. So you kill somebody, an image bearer of God, that's serious business, folks. You're going to die. You're guilty. You're going to die. So capital punishment is not chiefly for revenge. It's not for reforming the killer. It's not for deterring other killers. You know, people love to debate that. Reforming the killer, I'd like to see that. I don't think, you know, there's not a lot of that going on in the prisons today. Deterring other killers, I've heard people say that it actually doesn't deter people who are bound and determined to kill other people. I don't know about that. I think maybe, it's been a long time since I looked at the evidence of that. That's a statistical thing. And certainly it's not for revenge, because justice is not revenge. We're not supposed to have private revenge. The purpose of capital punishment is to satisfy and uphold the justice of God. That's what it's there for. I remember reading a good essay by C.S. Lewis to that effect. And see, today people who defend capital punishment, they constantly go to the deterrence. I don't care about deterrence. I mean, I hope it does deter crime, but that's not the reason. It's justice. I mean, I saw, this is not capital case, but I just saw a movie where a pedophile, not only a pedophile, he raped his two daughters, anally raped his two daughters. It was in Canada. And that judge gave the man 10 months in jail with 2 years probation. And I thought, well, you know, that's liberalism to the max. That's liberalism that spits in the eye of God. That's liberalism that denies justice. It's absurd. And the people who made the movie, the actors in the movie, the script, said nothing about that. They didn't complain about that sentence. That's just the way it was. It's absurd. Now note the implications concerning the fall about the image of God still being in man. Now this is after the fall. Somebody has been killed bearing the image of God. The image of God was still in mankind after the fall. Otherwise, God would not have protected it with capital punishment. So there, when you get to your tulip, you know, when you talk about original or total depravity, it doesn't mean that the image, total depravity does not mean that the image of God is entirely erased from humans because of Adam's sin. No, we still bear the image of God. And that's why when somebody murders a baby in his mother's womb with abortion, that murderer who did that killed a human being who was made in the image of God. That's serious business. Now let's look at verse 5 here in Genesis 9. I will require the life of every animal and every man for your life and your blood. Well, we've talked about requiring the life of men who murder people, but how about an animal that kills somebody? Actually, verse 5 says the animal must be killed. I will require the life of every animal for your life and your blood. In other words, if an animal kills somebody, he's got to go down. He's got to be killed. That's the easiest way of reading that. Now, Adam Clark's got an interesting way of reading that scripture. He says if someone kills an animal, that person should be killed. He reverses it. Now, I don't know the Hebrew again, but I just think that is absolutely ridiculous. That's so ridiculous, I'm not even sure that people for the ethical treatment of animals, PETA, would go along with that. Someone kills an animal, that person should be killed. I'm not even sure PETA's that radical. I mean, Clark even says that horse racers shall give an account to God because they're racing horses. There are plenty of other verses in the scriptures to warn against cruelty to animals. This one should not be misinterpreted for that goal, folks. This is talking about the animal being killed, not a human being killed for killing the animal, but killing the animal for killing a human. Now, let's look at the provision in the law that codifies this sentiment of God. Exodus 21, 28 through 32. When an ox gores a man or a woman to death, the ox must be stoned, and its meat may not be eaten, but the ox's owner is innocent. However, if the ox was in the habit of goring, and its owner has been warned, yet does not restrain it, and it kills a man or a woman, the ox must be stoned, and its owner must also be put to death. Now, this is what the law, I think we'd call this second-degree murder. First-degree murder is when you willfully and meditate and plan the murder, intentional murder. Second-degree murder is when you act so grossly negligent. You don't mean to kill somebody, but you're so grossly negligent that you're going to pay with your life. And that's the modern American law, if I remember from law school, okay, and I think I do. This is the Jewish law, and it's very similar. The man knows he's got a dangerous ox. He's negligent. He doesn't restrain it. That's grossly negligent. He's going to pay. It's the same as he would in American law, I believe. Now, verse 30 says, if instead a ransom is demanded of him, he can pay a redemption price for his life in the full amount demanded from him. Now, if you recall from the verses I read about the manslaughterers in the cities of refuge, you couldn't redeem a manslaughterer. He had to stay in the city of refuge until the high priest died, and you couldn't buy him out. A relative could not pay the temple. Oh, no, there wasn't a temple then, maybe, but, well, yeah, there was a temple there. What am I saying? When the law was in effect, a manslaughterer could not be bought out of his, shall we say, confinement in the city of refuge. He couldn't be bought out with a ransom. But here, if it's manslaughter that's done with an ox, an animal, I say manslaughter, maybe second-degree murder, depends on how you want to classify it. In that case, he cannot be redeemed. Same thing if the ox gores a son of her daughter, verse 31, he is to be dealt with according to the same law. It means if there's criminal negligence on the part of the ox owner, he dies. He's executed, even if it's his own son or daughter. Now, verse 32, if the ox gores a male or female slave, he must give 30 shekels of silver to the slave's master, and the ox must be stoned. By the way, that verse is how we know the value of Judas. When Judas sold Jesus out for 30 pieces of silver, that's exactly the price of a slave. That's how we know that from this verse right here. So the animal dies too. Now you might ask, well, why? Well, I think it's just, for one thing, the animal's probably dangerous. It needs to be put down. And I think another reason might be because it shows how valuable human life is. And so kind of a symbolic thing to kill the animal that killed the human. But at any rate, the animal goes down too. All right, that's a lot of, shall we say, rabbit trails from Genesis 9:6. Let's go to Genesis 9:5 and 6. Let's go to Genesis 9:7-11. But you, be fruitful and multiply, spread out over the earth and multiply on it. Then God said to Noah and his sons with him, understand that I am confirming my covenant with you and your descendants after you, and with every living creature that is with you, birds, livestock, and all wildlife of the earth that are with you, all the animals of the earth that came out of the ark. Now notice that the covenant is not only with Noah, but it's also with all the creatures on the earth. Verse 11, Genesis 9, I confirm my covenant with you that never again will every creature be wiped out by the waters of a flood. There will never again be a flood to destroy the earth. Now, why does God say in Genesis 9:7 for Noah and his progeny to be fruitful and multiply? Well, that was especially necessary because there's only 8 of mankind has been left. They got a lot of multiplying to do. We see this in Genesis 9:19, 8 verses later. These three sons, as Ham, Shem, and Japheth, were Noah's sons, and from them the whole earth was populated. Now, I have a question. Does this command apply to us today to be fruitful and multiply? I know there's a lot of people, for example, in the Catholic Church, for example, the homeschool, evangelical Protestant homeschool movement, who talk a lot about having children, and I think that's great. You know, the children are arrows in your quiver and so forth. But I have a question. Now, when there's eight people, it makes sense to be fruitful and multiply in the case of Noah. In the case of Adam, there were two people, Adam and Eve. They really needed to be fruitful and multiply. In fact, all throughout early history, Jewish history, the Jewish women wanted to have a kid, not only because they might have the Messiah, but it was so deeply ingrained in their culture, they had to have children to maintain themselves, to survive as a people. But now we have 4.5 billion people. It's not quite as necessary. Well, I will say this. These population experts who say the population bomb, people like Paul Ehrlich, are anti-people. Some of them go so far as to say we need to start killing off humans, you know, so there's enough people, there's enough room on the planet to hold everybody. Well, those arguments are very interesting. Paul Ehrlich was completely wrong about the population bomb, about the earth just breaking down under the burden of so many people. I mean, because, you know, there's science, there's technology. We learn how to control the pollution, environmental engineering, environmental science. We got a lot of people now, and the world could actually hold a lot more. So I don't buy these arguments that we need to be against people having children just because there's 4.5 billion, or maybe more today, billion people on the earth today. And I will note that if it's been statistically shown that if a country does not, what is it, if they do not reproduce at 2.2 children per family, that the country will eventually die out. I know that Japan is having a horrible time because they don't allow internal immigration from outside to preserve their culture, but then they don't have children. And so they're not reproducing themselves. They're closing elementary schools down one after the other. I remember reading an article by Peter Drucker, the management guru. In fact, he's the guy that gave the term management to the discipline. He said that Europe was going to go through a population crisis because there was not enough people to man the factories and to provide markets and so forth, which I thought was quite interesting and counterintuitive to what we hear today. But anyway, that's an interesting subject if you want to get into it. But nothing wrong with being fruitful and multiple. Not to mention the social things. I mean, when you have more kids, the kids learn how to get along with each other better. Hopefully, they learn to sacrifice. It has to do with the molding of a family. It helps. Now, this never again would God wipe out the earth. He's already said that, actually, in Genesis 8:21, when Noah came out of the ark and offered a sacrifice. Genesis 8:21, when the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, he said to himself, I will never again curse the ground because of man, even though man's inclination is evil from his youth, and I will never again strike down every living thing as I have done. Now, that never again could be don't curse the earth like he did when Adam sinned, or it could be never again curse the earth because of the flood, in which case Genesis 9 verse 11 is a repetition of his promise never again to curse the earth after Adam sinned. But here, it's very explicit. Genesis 9:11, I will never again wipe out every creature by the waters of a flood. So it's a promise there's never going to be a flood. Genesis 8:21 is a promise that the ground will never be cursed again. And again, that you have to speculate as to what that is there. I believe it's the flood. We go now to Genesis 9:12. I believe it's a flood that will never again come upon the earth. Genesis 9:12-17. And God said, this is the sign of the covenant I am making between me and you, Noah, and every living creature with you. Again, notice the covenant is not just with Noah. It's also with all the other living all the other living creatures, a covenant for all future generations. I have placed my bow in the clouds. That's the rainbow. And it will be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. Whenever I form clouds over the earth and the bow appears in the clouds, I will remember my covenant between me and you and all the living creatures. Water will never again become a flood to destroy every creature. The bow will be in the clouds, and I will look at it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and all the living creatures on earth. God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant that I have confirmed between me, and every creature on earth. Now, there's a sign here. That's the rainbow. It's the sign of the Noahic covenant. This is typical of covenants. All covenants have a sign, or at least many of them do. The Abrahamic covenant was circumcision. We see in Genesis 17:11, you must circumcise the flesh of your foreskin to serve as a sign of the covenant. Mosaic, under the Mosaic covenant, the Sabbath was the sign. Exodus 31:16-17, the Israelites must observe the Sabbath, celebrating it throughout their generations as a perpetual covenant. It is a sign forever between me. So the Sabbath is a sign of the covenant. And the new covenant, the sign of the new covenant is the Lord's Supper. As long as you eat this bread and drink this cup, it's a, do this unto remembrance of me like a sign. You're proclaiming to the world that there's a new covenant. So you see signs are everywhere, and this sign is a rainbow, and it has symbolic significance. I think the Abrahamic sign of circumcision means that you got to circumcise your flesh to show that when you naturally propagate children, they're going to be weak because of their original sin that you're passing on. And that's debated, but I kind of think that's what it is. The Mosaic covenant, the Sabbath, is the symbol of that, is referring back to the creation week when God rested from his labors, and God wanted the Israelites to rest from their labors. So now let's look at the bow. The rainbow is the sign of the Noahic covenant, the covenant of Noah. First of all, let's discuss whether there were rainbows before the flood. Now, the NIV Study Bible says that rainbows must have been present before this, and I agree with them. The difference now is that after the flood, they are invested with symbolic significance. Like I said, these signs typically symbolize something. We'll talk about what it symbolizes in just a minute, but it symbolizes something, so that means that there could be rainbows before the flood as well as after the flood. However, there are some people that say that rainbows were not present before the flood. Here's a good quote from John Gill. Quote, "It is a question whether there was a rainbow before the flood, and it is not easily answered. Both Jews and Christians are divided about it. The greater part of Christian interpreters are of the mind that it was from the beginning." Well, of course it was from the beginning. I mean, you'd have to have a suspension of natural laws not to have rainbows. It's amazing that people get so worked up over this. Apparently, John Gill says a lot of people have been arguing about it, but no, there was rainbows before the flood. But this rainbow that you see now has symbolism behind it, and the symbolism is, sun's always going to be shining, folks, and it's going to be a beautiful day, no more flood. That perhaps might have a physical implication behind it, because rainbows occur when clouds thin out and the sun shines through the clouds. And now if the clouds are thinning out and the sun is shining through the clouds, that means there's no more rain coming. And if there's no more rain coming, there's no more flood, and that means God is never going to flood the earth again. Never again will I flood the earth. I think that reasonably explains the symbolism of the rainbow. Now notice in verse 16, that God says the bow will be in the clouds. That does not mean that the rainbow will be in the clouds every single time there was rain. It means only at certain times, and I think that ought to be obvious. Ladies and gentlemen, I have finished Genesis 9, verses 1 through 17. We have finished our discussion of God's covenant with Noah. In our next audio, we will go to verses 18 through 29 of Genesis 9, and we'll talk about Ham, Shem, and Japheth, the three sons of Noah from whom the world was populated again. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.